You're listening to The Takeaway Podcast. Check out our website at thetakeaway.org. You'll find other interesting stories, quizzes, and behind-the-scenes photos and videos.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening, and Merry Christmas to all our listeners out there celebrating this holiday and reflecting on their own spiritual lives with the people closest to them. One of the world's most prominent and important Christian leaders, Pope Francis, has reached out to the poor of Rome this Christmas with personal gifts of free public transit vouchers and telephone cards, signed Christmas pictures. The Pope's gentle gesture of practical help for the poor, his own unique and already familiar and even controversial style. Francis, who has devoted enormous energy on the poor, who has critiqued the inflexible dogma and tradition of the Catholic Church, critiqued the priorities of the global economy, and has had to answer the charge that he is a Marxist, all while carrying on a lively identity in the digital social media world. Humanity is experiencing a turning point in its history, the Pope has said earlier this year. Debates over whether the Pope is a Marxist, whether secular life is a godless life, these are the sorts of conversations we want to share with you this hour. A Pew Foundation study published this year suggested that at the center of some of these debates and conversations are so-called millennials, born since 1980. They are less likely to embrace the traditions of their parents, and one in four claim no affiliation at all, openly declare atheism or no belief when asked. We wanted to explore this by reaching out to people who have experienced it firsthand.
I think most of us kind of consider it sort of a buffet style of pick and choose the different aspects of previous religious traditions.
I describe myself as the pork-eating, alcohol-drinking, premarital, sex-having variety of Muslim.
I'm just as likely to read the story of the Tower of Babel in the Bible as I am to read a story by Isaac Babel, the Russian Jewish writer, and get as much inspiration from one as I do from the other.
Throughout the hour on this Christmas Day, we'll revisit some of these young people from various faiths that aired earlier this year on The Takeaway. And we begin by looking at the community of Jews in America, an estimated 5 million people, where there may be a deep shift in identity going on. For the post-1980 generation who were raised Jewish, only 68% identify as Jews by religion, according to that Pew study, while 32% describe themselves as having no religion, even if they claim Judaism through ancestry, ethnicity, or culture.
I'm a staff writer at Tablet Magazine, which is a very Jewish magazine. But among my friends, I'm also known as the guy who makes really great breakfast tacos with bacon in them. There's a certain kind of split there.
That's the voice of Adam Chandler. He's 31 years old, grew up in a Reformed Jewish family in Houston, Texas. We also spoke with Michael Yashinsky, a 24-year-old millennial who grew up in a conservative Jewish household in the suburbs of Detroit. And Sarah Seltzer, 32 years old, works at the National Council for Jewish Women. What do they have in common? Quite a lot, including a skepticism about religious authorities in Israel attempting to enforce and define Jewish traditions around the world.
I'd say that probably these Jews in Israel that you talk about, these very observant Jews, they realize that a Jew is a Jew. They may be somewhat lapsed in their observance of Jewish law, but I think they would still accept us as Jews and embrace us. You have to realize that Jews are now and have always been a collection of so many disparate types.
So tradition strong as far as you're concerned, Michael. Sarah, how about you?
I agree. I think that it's very important to have a sense of Jewishness. I think that secular Jews have existed probably since the beginning of Judaism. So I think that a lot of this hand-wringing over Jews leaving the fold and being lapsed, I think, is a bit misplaced. And I also think it doesn't take the sort of current context into account. I mean, this generation are finding so many interesting creative ways to be Jewish, whether it's through cultural exploration or through all the Jewish publications. I really, really believe that embracing that rather than sort of casting it away is the key to the survival of Jews, particularly in America.
And how about you, Mr. Bacon?
I absolutely agree with that. I think the pronouncements that are made about the decline or, the failings of modern young secularish Jews is it's a problem because it's shutting people away from the community, which is ultimately the wrong thing
it's
to do.
It's sort of self-defeating and self-fulfilling prophecy almost.
But I wonder, there was one thing that was troubling about that Pew survey, I think. There was one statistic I read that a large percentage of Jews believe that their main manifestation of their Jewishness is their sense of humor. And of course, a lot of people have a sense of humor. It's got to be something more uniquely Jewish than that. That can't be what makes you Jewish. So a lot more people said that than those who said that their observance of Jewish custom or law makes them Jewish.
Seinfeldians. That's what we would call the American Jews.
Yeah, and I'd say that Judaism may not have a great chance of sticking around for thousands of years if, you know, the main thing that makes people Jewish today is a heightened appreciation of Seinfeld. There's got to be something more. There's got to be something deeper, I think.
I definitely agree with that, but I also sense the way that culturally people who grew up Jewish or who are Jewish, even if they don't say they're Jewish or by name are Jewish or by birth are Jewish, sort of chronicle the experiences of living in a community, and a lot of it's manifested through humor, acts as a portal for other people to look into the community and understand all of the ways that it functions and also dysfunctions and sort of sees the humanity in it. And I don't think there's anything terribly wrong with that sort of understanding of Jewish culture because there's something underneath it.
I'm wondering if, and this is, I think, relatively unique to the Jewish experience, certainly as compared to Christianity, if all of you, despite your various practices and various sense of having moved away from tradition, have within you a kind of, in case of deep emotional tragedy or experience, break glass, and you essentially buy it all, that you can imagine yourself in the deepest sort of traditional Jewish ceremony as a reaction to a personal crisis of one kind or another, and that you could go there even if today you don't agree with what the Hasidics are doing over here and the Orthodox are doing over here and the Reforms are doing over here. Michael?
I'd say I can't foresee an emotional crisis like that happening. God forbid, I shouldn't like an emotional crisis to happen. But probably something else in my life might change, namely maybe marrying and raising children, which I hope will happen. And that, I think, will necessarily change my Jewish practice because as a father, as a husband, I would like to be, I think, a model of what it is to be a Jew in the world and what it is to be a learned Jew and a grounded Jew and also a spiritually yearning Jew, trying to be better, trying to be more connected. So I'd say probably my practice would firm up maybe and be even deeper as I grow up, I think.
I have 5 kids, Michael. Believe me, sometimes it does feel like a spiritual crisis. But go ahead, Sarah.
I do to an extent. Jewish mourning rituals are really important to me. I mean, I think that the Kaddish is something that even the most secular Jew might come back to because it connects us to all the losses in our past and in our future. And it's this really beautiful, sad thread that connects us. My feminism is in sort of direct contrast with that deep, deep practice of Judaism. And I think that there's always going to be a part of me. Even when I became a bat mitzvah, I was up there on the podium complaining about Orthodox sexism. So that's sort of like a huge part of who I am. And I think that I could never sort of break glass and go all the way in. But I definitely think that I could turn to more ritual and more Judaism. But I can't ever sort of see myself going to a rabbi. I'd rather go to a therapist, and I think that's very cultural, modern Jew of me.
Adam?
You know, I spent my freshman year a gap year in between high school and college in Israel when the Second Intifada broke out there. And, you know, we were a lot of sheltered American kids living in Israel and away from our parents for the first time. And, you know, I remember there was a certain importance that was placed on community gatherings, especially on Shabbat, to sort of be together in a specific moment as a community. The next year, I started my freshman year at school in Washington, D.C., and 3 weeks into my freshman year, September 11th happened. And so I remember in the weeks after, we were doing sort of different outreach efforts between not only Jewish community and other religious communities, but within the groups that normally didn't draw that many people to Shabbat services or to events. People were coming out, and I felt that the community is always going to be there, even if one night it's 15 people and another night it's 50.
And there is great comfort in that. I can see it in your face. Yeah. Well, Adam, Sarah, and Michael, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you very much.
Religious identity may be an even more disruptive issue in Muslim American households. Millennials constitute a distinct group of first-generation Muslims born in America. They tend to grow up in close-knit families where faith is a cornerstone of identity. Their encounter with the secular America around them has caused something of a spiritual earthquake for the three young Muslim American guests we spoke with earlier this year. Zahra Nurbash's family comes from Iran. Tasneem's family, she asked us not to use her last name, comes from South Asia. And fellow first namer Cameron's roots are Afghanistan. This young man, still in his 20s, is living a set of contradictions that confront him every single day.
I actually believe that my life is a Venn diagram. I was born here in the United States. My parents emigrated to the country about 30-some years ago. And I have, of course, my Afghan background and my religious background being Muslim. And then also having grown up here in the United States, I've got my Western culture and background. So I feel I'm like in a small sliver of a Venn diagram between the two different cultures and religions.
If your parents, Cameron, were listening to this conversation, what would they say about you?
Find a place in D.C., don't come back home.
Really?
I have my moments of being maybe a buffet-style Muslim where I do the things I'm not supposed to do, but I'm very secretive about it.
Tasneem, how do you react to this idea of a Venn diagram of different domains of your life as America encounters the Islam of your traditional family?
You know, I've lived in a number of different cities, and I very much agree with Cameron that it's a way of navigating that's very purposeful. I'm constantly asking myself, you know, what language am I speaking right now? And I don't always mean, you know, literal language, sort of what topics do I want to avoid? What customs do I want to make sure I don't insult? What secrets do I need to keep at this moment, depending on who I'm talking to? So it's a juggling act. There's
wow.
Another one.
I've got a headache there, that's for sure. Zahra Nurbash, let's talk a little bit about your experience with America's encounter with Islam. How's Islam doing?
Islam is doing fine. A little bit of an overcast over here. But I am an actor, comedian, writer. There are little secrets in my world. I describe myself as the pork-eating, alcohol-drinking, premarital, sex-having variety of Muslim.
Amen.
Thank you.
Wow.
And, you know, my parents know my whole life story simply because it's a part of my work. I write memoir. I have a one-woman show about my relationship with my atheist, infidel, whitey-white boyfriend, Duncan. And I think because I did grow up so very isolated and I did grow up feeling like I was in that same Venn diagram, that I now have very little containment for secrets. And I don't see any conflict between my saying that I'm Muslim and the way that I practice.
We're going to take a short break and we'll continue our conversation with Zahra, Tasneem, and Cameron in just a minute. Stay with us. Continuing now with three young Muslim Americans who joined us earlier this year for a series we did exploring young people and their faith identity in a time of change. Before the break, we were introduced to Tasneem, Cameron, and Zahra Nurbash, three young Muslims all born in America who have different approaches to the faith of their parents. For Zahra, who was by far the most aggressive in this trio of tradition busters, nearly every decision she has made to stray from the traditional path has caused some sort of dramatic scene.
When I first introduced my boyfriend to my parents, you know, they were thrilled. I was 25. I had not introduced them to any other man at that point, and they thought, great, great, somebody likes her. And when I told them that I wanted to move in with him and that we weren't getting married, that was a conversation that turned into a one-woman show. And it took a lot of arguing, and my mother was actually the one who said, you know, you both are so full of pride and you both think you're absolutely right, and because of that you're going to tear this family apart. And she burst into tears and left us arguing in the living room. And I think it was the threat of us feeling like we could potentially lose each other, that my father and I, we realized that one of us had to budge. And my father came up with this pre-engagement ceremony. You know, he called me like at midnight later that night. And what he had said was that the word Muslim means one who believes in a force greater than himself. And that that is the definition of a Muslim. And if Duncan believed in a force greater than himself, then he was Muslim. And I said, well, he's not spiritual like that. You know, he thinks religion is due to the lack of an economic infrastructure. And my dad said, well, come on. Does he believe in gravity? Is gravity a force greater than Duncan? You know, and I was like, Duncan, do you believe in gravity? And he was like, yeah, that's one I can stand behind. And my dad said, all right, he believes in gravity. It is a force greater than himself. He's Muslim.
That's remarkable. All right, so everybody has to go through a certain amount of gymnastics to try to maintain their life. Tasneem, what is the most Muslim thing you tried to do and it failed for you in your life to try to negotiate all of this?
My grandmother met a man once or twice and married him. And my mom met a man once or twice and married him. And I, after years of dating, hit my mid-20s and suddenly had this, like, insatiable need to meet somebody who understood how I grew up and who could be comfortable with my parents and who my parents could be comfortable with as well. And I did meet somebody with whom I shared a lot of that culture. And I ended up meeting him once or twice and married him. My friends were just flabbergasted, you know, because they knew my story and they knew how hard I'd worked to try to recreate my life in my own, you know, in my own fashion, which is really hard. I mean, one of the things I didn't understand when I started pulling away, and I started pulling away pretty young, I think I was in middle school, actually, was that when you grow up in a really tight-knit community like that, if you leave, you don't get another one. You have to build it yourself. And that's a lot of work. And I think that's part of the reason I wanted to meet somebody, you know, where we could still hold on to parts of that, you know, what we were born into. But, you know, it turns out that that's not enough always.
Didn't work.
And it does take years sometimes to figure out our relationship to this stuff.
All right. So Zahra, 33, and Tasneem, 31. The youngest of our trio here, Cameron, has gotten very quiet all of a sudden, possibly looking forward to the kinds of experiences that have just been shared.
Yes.
Cameron, any reaction, any thoughts about doing something very Muslim as a way of resolving your dilemma or very un-Muslim to resolve your dilemma, as both Zahra and Tasneem have shared with us?
I broke out of the mold, I guess, at 18 and got into my first relationship with an American girl. And that caused a whole lot of friction at home, a whole lot. And that friction, ultimately, the ultimatum was, hey, pick her or us. So I went with what they said and I broke up the relationship. And then when I went away to pharmacy school, I met somebody in pharmacy school and secretly, again, dated them. And they found out, and same sort of thing happened. So I haven't met anybody, I guess you could say, of my community, of my religion. I haven't met that person yet.
But even if you date someone outside of Islam, there's also this other criteria that you just identified. Your love for them has to be worth the misery you're going to go through to break with your family, and that's also a threshold that probably almost no relationship could endure.
Right. I do have very strong ties with my parents, and that's how I was raised, was you are a part of a community. You know, out here in the Western world, all of my buddies and all my friends that I've met along the way, very individualistic, where they could move anywhere they wanted, they can do whatever they wanted, they'd see their families once or twice a year, whereas the way that I grew up was more, everything that you do is for the family, and everything the family does is for the community.
Tasneem and Zahra, is it all or nothing for Cameron? Any advice for him? It seems like a collision to me.
I really have so much empathy for the position that Cameron is in. This is the moment that I found myself in as well, before I was able to tell my parents that Duncan and I we're going to be living together. And what I see there is a difference between religion and family and tradition and separation. You know, I think that's generational. I think it's terrifying. I think it's very different than religion. I don't like the word cherry pick, and I don't like the idea of a Muslim buffet, because it suggests that there's a right way to do it, and it suggests that there's an authority on this. And my recollection of studying my religion as a child and growing up is that in Islam, I have a direct connection with God, and I get to say, you know, what that relationship is like and what it requires. I am the authority on my faith. The same way that I could know in the back of my mind that there are people listening to this who 100% disagree with me and are offended, they also can know that I, too, am offended at the notion that I am less Muslim than they are.
Religious Tolerance American Style, the voices of Muslim Americans. Zahra Nurbash, Tasneem, and Cameron, thank you so much for sharing these stories. It's been great talking to you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, John, for having me on the show today.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Merry Christmas, everyone, except all you atheists out there, right? That's not very Christian, I suppose. But the idea that someone can believe in no God and still keep religious traditions was among the most interesting things we learned in our series earlier this year on the changing face of religion in America. In the journey from a Christian upbringing to the embrace of no God, you bring a lot of traditional baggage along, we found out. We hear now once again from Emily Peterson from Boston, Daniel Munoz from Texas, and Amber Van Atten from New York City. For Emily, her journey, you might say, began at Lake Wobegon, only not in Minnesota.
I was brought up as a Lutheran Christian in Delaware, and my family is still very religious. I was pretty religious growing up, too. And as an adolescent, I realized I had a lot of questions. And at one point in my development, I told myself, well, you know, this is the brain God gave me, and it is curious, and it wants to understand. And I came to realize that I didn't actually have a belief in God anymore.
Daniel Munoz, your story.
Well, I was raised Catholic in the heart of Texas, and against everything my parents wanted, I ended up losing faith when I was maybe 13 or 14, as I learned more about science and philosophy and started to feel like Christianity didn't make sense to me anymore.
And Amber Van Atten, what's your trajectory?
I was raised in a sort of vaguely religious family. We went to a Presbyterian church, and then my mom had a near-death experience and became sort of this really radical born-again Christian almost overnight when I was 9 or 10 years old. And basically forced my entire family to convert. And I was young enough that I sort of went along with it for a while. But then as I got a little bit older, I started to understand how restrictive it was. And then I really quickly sort of just decided that this wasn't for me. It sort of became a big thing, and I ended up leaving my family because my mom told me I was going to hell, and she couldn't handle me not believing.
You know, the revolutions down through the last couple of millennia that relate to religion, religious denominations, and the upheavals that have taken place in monotheism almost exclusively are a tension between the social rituals of a religious group and people's personal identity with God. Are you three taking it a step further and saying, I don't need a relationship with God, I certainly don't need a relationship with the church, and kind of just all of you leave me alone? Daniel?
I think people in my group know that religion offers people some very valuable things, but there's a lot of stuff we disagree with, personal relationship with God, even the rituals. So we're trying to find the parts of religion that we do see as valuable, like communion, brotherhood, sisterhood, and keep that, but get rid of the stuff that we think is morally unacceptable.
Emily?
I actually agree with a lot of what Daniel's saying. I found a lot of positivity in my church community growing up, and I was reluctant to walk away from that when I realized I no longer shared the supernatural beliefs. But in Boston, I found my humanist community and feel a sense of belonging. I think most of us kind of consider it sort of a buffet style of pick and choose the different aspects of
previous religious traditions.
Amber, where have you gone in the buffet, if at all?
I sort of align very closely with a lot of Buddhist principles and have found a lot of solace and completeness in my life through meditation and yoga.
And Daniel, how about you? What models are attractive to you well outside your Catholic faith?
Well, I don't eat at the religious buffet when it comes to morality. I don't even eat in the same restaurant. I look for inspiration to secular ethicists. I think we need to really start fresh and think about what makes life valuable in totally new terms.
Daniel Munoz, Emily Peterson, and Amber Van Atten. Later this hour, On Being's Krista Tippett gets right to the heart of what you heard Daniel talking about there and asks whether this generation could actually usher in an era of spiritual awakening. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
So far this hour, the who of this spiritual transformation in America we explored earlier this year. But how about the what and the where? For instance, what places in America are we more likely to run into a young Jewish American like Adam, who talked openly to us about his pork-eating lifestyle? Where do the religious Jews live? Anywhere near people who say they are more culturally Jewish? Or where are you likely to find households with a spiritual feud going on, like Zahra, who is making up her own brand of Islam, no matter what her parents say? And is it everywhere in America that you can find folks like Emily, who loves all the Christian ritual but completely rejects the Christian Bible? During our series earlier this year, I talked with Dante Chinney, director of the American Communities Project, about what the numbers show about millennials and their changing relationship to their faith.
Millennials are the latest iteration of this, but I think we've seen this even going back to Gen Xers before them. There has been a gradual, over the last couple generations, walking away from religion, and millennials are further, it seems, along that path than generations before them, yeah.
And they're starting to make their sort of cultural impact known. But how does all of this break down by race, urban, rural? You know, you love the urban-rural thing.
I do love the urban-rural thing because it's just so clearly where there's a divide now. And when you look at the urban-rural split in the country right now, what's happened is there aren't a lot of jobs in rural America. So if you go to college, you got a chance to, you think, do something bigger, make a little more money, you head to a city. Rural America is much older than the rest of the country, and urban areas are younger. There are a lot of millennials in urban areas. And the data on this really backs this up. Rural areas, when you look at this in terms of, we have big data polls from Experian, the consumer research firm, which asks people everything, not just about where they eat and shop. But people are 25% more likely to say they are conservative evangelical Christians, 25% more likely than the nation as a whole, and obviously much more likely than that when you compare it to urban areas. And also, people in those rural areas are 20% more likely to say they enjoy watching religious television programs. So what we're talking about here, this split that's happening with millennials, I do think it's happening across the culture. But I think it's really pushing kind of metropolitan urban America further down a path that is away from rural
America. Hey, the godless cities, isn't that what they say when you leave home and go absolutely make your fame and fortune? Well, one of the things that's in the data that's really interesting is the fact that even in rural areas, the religion that people ascribe to, if they're millennials, might be different from their parents. So the actual embrace of religion could be a form of rebellion in itself. The Jewish population is very, very interesting in the Pew study. The stats show that for a huge number, being Jewish is not much more than knowledge of the Holocaust and some vague idea of ethics. What's that about?
Well, this is something that's been going on for a while, right? These are people who identify themselves as being cultural Jews, right? I'm culturally Jewish, but I'm not very religious. There is always the question, and the poll makes this point, that this is where these people are now. Is this where they're going to be 10 years from now? A lot of times religion, a more kind of standardized version, more formal version of religion, is something you come to later in life, something when you have children and you want to kind of get the values that were put into you, inculcated to them. But we'll have to wait and see. I mean, this difference between saying you're a strict adherent to a religion and being a cultural follower of something, it's a Jewish phenomena, but it's also, you see it among Catholics. There are people who call themselves cultural Catholics.
And it's a kind of a sleeper cultural phenomenon. I mean, it's possible, and members of the clergy do say this, that as time goes on, as you pass milestones in your life, those cultural traditions may become more religious. Dante Chinney, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Dante Chinney is director of the American Communities Project at American University.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
You know, America is the land of religious renewal. It defines us as much as anything. There were the Puritans, the Amish, you got the Mormons, the Unification Church, Scientology, Reformed Judaism, I could go on. America is a laboratory of spiritual change, despite that pious-sounding and ubiquitous slogan, "In God We Trust." So our young panelists of Christians, Jews, and Muslims, millennials, and their struggles to define faith for their time, are part of an American tradition. But do they represent a spiritual yearning for deeper truths, or do they simply represent a lapse from customs and beliefs outmoded and no longer relevant? We decided to put this question to Krista Tippett, host of the public radio program On Being and the author of Speaking of Faith.
It's definitely true that religious identity is as fluid and a matter of personal choice, I think, than it's been in human history for many centuries, if ever. You know, just as we don't inherit other kinds of identity that we adhere to, religious identity has been kind of unmoored from necessarily being identified with the family we grew up in, the church we went to, the synagogue we went to. But I also, what's been interesting to me to watch, and I'm not sure this gets so reflected in polls, which, you know, are flat in a sense, is that the spirituality of the millennials is not the New Age superficial spirituality of the 80s and 90s. This is also the generation that has a huge service orientation. This is the generation that's given us social entrepreneurialism. And so even as they detach from institutional affiliation, and that's really what the Pew polls are measuring, I find a lot of these people who describe themselves as non-religious or non-affiliated as, you know, incredibly ethically engaged, spiritually curious, and even theologically curious. So that's what I've been watching evolve. And that, to me, is just seems to be deepening.
I'm sensing a Calvinism meets crowdsourcing here, a stewardship and service affiliated with the new digital social identities.
There was a German theologian of mid-20th century, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who had a very dramatic story, died in a Nazi prison. And in his time, the church had been absolutely taken captive and given itself over to culture in a way that completely distorted what it was to be in the world. And Bonhoeffer coined this phrase, religionless Christianity. What he believed was that the essence of Christian teachings that had survived 2,000 years would also even survive the death of religion, as he'd known it, the death of the church. And we live in a very different age. You know, what's gone wrong with churches now is what's going wrong with a lot of our institutions. The forms don't fit the time we're in. But I really feel in some ways that a lot of these millennials, a lot of these, what the Pew people have also called the nuns, the N-O-N-E-S, you know, no affiliation.
Right. Right.
We may look back 50 years from now and say, this was a force for spiritual renewal. You know, change always comes from the margins. And as I say, what a lot of these people are about, their critique of organized religion, is that it's not about service. It's not about spiritual depth. It does not have a nourishing, redemptive influence on public life. And I tweeted about this a couple months ago, and I heard from all kinds of pastors and rabbis who have churches and congregations filled with these people who profess no affiliation, but they are there to get at what they see as the basics.
Well, you mentioned the you know, values transformations that took place in the 50s and 60s. And, you know, having grown up in that time, I do recall that as a kind of repudiation of organized religion as being hypocritical in some way. This seems to be a much more powerful statement of, no, it's just not really relevant to me. And so there's a reinvention going on.
Yes. They're not bothering to spend a lot of energy repudiating the institution. they just don't, you're right, they don't see it as relevant. But what I'm saying is that what they are defining as relevant and what they're crafting instead of just returning to the church or synagogue or mosque that their parents went to is, in many cases, a robust form of spiritual, ethical, even theologically grounded living. And then, you know, as millennials grow older, it's also a natural progression in human life that you hit moments of life where you face your vulnerability, you face illness, you have children, you hit midlife, you start asking questions of meaning and purpose that you weren't asking when you were 18 or 25. And what happens in those times is that people often gravitate back towards the institutions for some of the essential things that you can't find elsewhere, like community, like ritual. So again, I'm going to be interested to see when this generation return in some way to the institutions or to at least experimenting with them, they're going to bring a whole new set of questions. They're going to bring a set of practices. They're going to bring education in terms of all the things they've been reading and doing. They're going to bring a history of service. And again, I think they may be transformative for the institutions eventually.
Now, that sounds fabulous. But what if they just let us down and they just become a generation like any other? You know, it's like basically.
Well, they will, of course.
Yes.
They will, because, you know, my favorite line of theology, I think, is Reinhold Niebuhr, the public theologian. The first line of his great book, The Nature and Destiny of Man, is man is his own most vexing problem. And it's a great truth about humanity that even when we are pursuing our highest ideals, even in our moments of greatest accomplishment, we will fail, we will be flawed, and we'll be forced to confront our dark side again. And, you know, this generation will have its version of that. But I think in terms of a curiosity and a willingness to entertain very big ideas, I think they bring a whole different set of instincts. And those instincts are going to serve the world better than the instincts of a lot of us who came out of the latter part of the 20th century.
Krista Tippett, host of On Being and author of Speaking of Faith. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
So with all this talk of change and redefinition of faith and God, what's a reverend to do, or a rabbi, or an imam? How do members of the clergy respond when they hear the kinds of things we've been hearing all hour? We'll end this hour with the voices of three members of the clergy we reached out to earlier this year, Rabbi Robert Nozenchuk of the Anshe Chesed Fairmount Temple in Beechwood, Ohio, Pastor Dennis Barill of the Community Covenant Church in Rehoboth, Massachusetts, and Imam Mustafa Omar with the Islamic Institute of Orange County, California. The rabbi told us, you have to listen to many questions from young people who accept few traditional answers at face value.
Well, we try when we engage this sort of millennial generation to help them not search for precision and clarity, but instead to accept the complexity with which faith comes to them in their life. In the case of Judaism, it's continually changing for our young people. Our young adults are full of unresolved questions. Even when they report to us that they see themselves or identify with no religion, many of those same adults find nothing more soothing or engaging than a nighttime prayer that reminds them of a Jewish tradition or Jewish faith. We have to reach people where they are and not wish away the circumstances of complexity with which young people find themselves.
Pastor Barill?
We've kind of taken the position that we welcome the questions. We, in fact, encourage the questions rather than pushing back on them at all. What I think the struggle is that a lot of us were brought up with Enlightenment teaching where everything was kind of yes and no, black and white. And so we're trying to recreate the idea that, no, this is mysterious. It's legitimate to question. It's legitimate to ask questions and to sit and wonder at the complexities of God. If we simply understood God, that would be even more bizarre if you really think about it. And so we're very content to engage with the question and, in fact, try to encourage it and create safe atmosphere for the questions.
Imam Umar, what are the encounters and experiences you've had with people who are conflicted about their faith or are trying to reinvent it completely as Muslims?
Well, for me, I actually went down the same road myself, growing up Muslim in America. So I can directly relate to exactly what these people are going through because I had my own crisis of faith, and I actually left Islam for about a year and became an atheist before coming back. So I think, you know, trying to at least validate their feelings and not telling them that, you know what, you're a sinner and you're the worst person in the world for thinking something like that, I think they feel a great sense of comfort. And especially in Islam, where we're taught to question, and in the Quran, many times it tells you that you should reflect and you should think about the teachings and you should not just accept things blindly. So I think that really resonates with a lot of young people and people who are going through this struggle.
Do any of you approach these young people, and we've heard in our discussion just how important this millennial generation seems to be culturally in America right now, whether we decide to reach them or make them our customers, whatever it is. They're a very important turning point in American history right now. Do you ever view them as, well, young folks, it's nice that you believe this now, but if you're ever interested in the upgrade to a real faith and a real participation in religion, I can help you with that. Reverend Burrill?
I wouldn't put it in those terms. I'd say that I like the idea that someone's interested at all in the conversation, because I think faith is a journey, and I think that our beliefs evolve much along with our life. And so I don't react to anyone at a particular point in their life, and what the millennial generation is engaged in right now doesn't necessarily predict its ending. I don't think there's an app or a quick thing that you're just trying to say, you know, sign up on the dotted line. I think that we all would hold that God is an exploration of life, not an exploration of a generation.
Imam, is a piety an upgrade of the religious experience if you've already accepted a certain sort of cultural Islam?
In a sense, from Islamic perspective, once you do believe in something, then you should carry it out to its full extent, or at least try your best. And assuming that everyone is capable of reaching a certain stage or a certain level of proximity or closeness with God, there are different grades. But to say particularly that one person is necessarily better than the other, that's not necessarily for us to judge. You know, that's for God to judge.
Rabbi?
John, I think that this notion of upgrade is kind of a, for lack of a better term, a vertical theology. Our young people want to engage horizontally. They want to make connections with one another and with us as fellow human beings. And I think that that's a message that radiates throughout the Jewish tradition. One of the Jewish text that's at the core of my rabbinate is centuries old. In the first century, Rabbi Hillel said, "Bimakom she'ein anashim, hishtadel lehiot ish," in a place where there's inhumanity, strive to be humane. And when I connect with people who are at some place on the outer circle of Jewish life, I want them to be able to always be striving, to be most comfortable as human beings, to strive to be a human being in their own skin, capable of asking and responding to important questions that they face in their lives.
To all of you, though, and in by way of conclusion, I'm wondering if there are limits to the extent to which these kinds of self-identified and self-invented spiritual journeys, you know, become offensive. And there are stories within the Jewish tradition of who is and who is not legitimately and sincerely on a journey towards God. Certainly in Christianity, the question of money changers in the temple, that sort of thing, was a story for Jesus. And in the stories of the prophet, the question of who is legitimately worshiping God and who is just sort of acting out is also a very important story in Islam. Do you see that question of pushing limits as part of this millennial journey and the experience that you're having with the people in your own congregations, Rabbi?
If folks are fond of pushing limits, that only makes the learning more exciting, John. When we look for teachings that folks can relate to about this, we can look back at the conclusion of Genesis when Jacob draws close with his grandchildren, Ephraim and Manasseh, and he looks at them in front of their father and says, "Who are these children?" They're truly assimilated into Egyptian culture. But what action does he take? He doesn't reject them because they're on the outer boundaries. He draws them close. In Judaism, we call this kiruv, and it's imperative that we draw individuals close in order to help them make judgments for themselves about where God is and where it might be.
Reverend Burrell?
Well, I think the concept of the great commandment, love God with all your heart and love your neighbors yourself, plays in here. And so clearly, I want people to come to know and love God through Jesus Christ. But at the same time, that has to have identity into loving their neighbor. So trying to bring young people to the realization that life is bigger than just themselves, it's beyond just themselves, and that what God calls them to is a life of being aware of the other, being aware of the neighbor, as well as him, and helping that bring definition will help people over time to realize that God's very relevant to their lives.
Imam?
It really depends on the individual's intention. Islam linguistically means surrender and submission to God. But really what people struggle with today, especially in a society where you know, very consumerist society, people basically struggle against their own desires. So in the end, they have to choose something. Are they submitting to their own desires and their own wants, or are they submitting to God? So it really depends on the intention of those individuals and what their real purpose of pushing these limits is in the end of the day.
Rabbi, Reverend, and Imam, it's been great, great talking to you. Thanks so much.
Likewise, thank you.
We want to thank all of our guests who shared their stories about faith in America earlier this year. You can find the entire series on our website by visiting us at thetakeaway.org/series/religion. And for everyone out there celebrating Christmas today, whether you are a Christian, a Jew, Muslim, atheist, white Santa, black Santa, hey, in public radio, we will take your pledge, whatever your faith. And that tradition won't change ever. Solid as the Vatican, kind of our Mecca or J-Town. Hey, before I say something to end my career, I want you to have a great holiday. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.